All right, it's really cool to see everybody here. I think I've been calling this session of the talks the power hour because there was so many really good talks right now. We were actually all afraid that no one would come and everybody would be over at Dowd's, and we're actually kind of excited about that because then we could go watch Dowd's talk too. But hey, it worked out. So we're glad to see you all here. We're going to talk about some new client-side attack vectors that are pretty interesting. Little intro for the group. I'm Nate McFeeters. I'm from Ernst & Young's Advanced Security Center. I got with me Rob Carter, who's also from Ernst & Young's Advanced Security Center, and John Heisman from NGS Software. Also contributing but not talking with us for many reasons we won't go into is Billy Rios from Microsoft. You can find him back in the room with the Marine shirt on there. But, yeah, he's a big contributing part to our research. So we're going to just the whole goal of our talk is to demonstrate a feasible compromise of an organization via client-side attacks that require no-code execution, and that even will work against IE in protected mode. So if you're over at Dowd's talk, you're hearing about memory corruption issues and bypassing the protections on that memory. If you're here, we're talking about something completely different that doesn't involve those traditional types of attacks, but still has similar results in the end. Here's our agenda. This slide is cram-packed with a bunch of junk that I'm not going to go into because it's going to take too long. And I instead boil it down to this slide, which describes it much more succinct. We're going to talk about flaws in domain-based trust, which I'll get into a little bit later. And we're going to talk about blended attacks. Blended attacks aren't something new, but they're a little bit new in the way that we're using them. Blended attacks used to be all about using the browser as sort of a staging point for several small pieces of attacks that would allow memory corruption or these types of issues. In this case, we're talking about different products and their interpretation of how they should handle security and how that different interpretation between each of these separate products might result in some serious compromises. We're going to also talk about Web 2.0 attacks, see some of that, and we're going to give weaponized examples against a lot of good well-known apps and show how this is a big deal even for those apps. I think one of the driving messages that I want to point out with the whole talk is that PCI, web application firewalls, any of the scanning tools out there, they're not going to help you find these issues. And that's really the point we're trying to get to. There's a lot of commoditization in security. This type of stuff is not commoditized. So it's pretty interesting stuff. Impact, this is a new slide that we've put out to cover the title of our talk, which now may seem a bit much considering Dan's DNS bug. When we called our talk the Internet is Broken, we didn't actually realize that Dan would subsequently break and then later fix the Internet. So in the grand scheme of things, our talk is somewhat less than that of Dan's research, but it's still very cool. It's still highly impactful, and it's certainly a lot more impactful than a lot of people realize. There's a ton of web applications that are affected by the types of attacks that we're going to talk about today, and many of these are, like I said, the most well-known and widely used domains out there. So get right into things. I'm going to talk a bit about the flaws of domain-based trust. And so what is domain-based trust? Well, domain-based trust is the trust that you put into a name. You trust that when you go to google.com, it's actually google.com. And that's part of Dan's talk with how the DNS is broken and these types of things. But similar vectors we're going to look at here. There's a lot of things that rely on domain-based trust, such as SSL certificates, phishing filters, the human trust factor, which I just talked about, and probably most importantly for our talk is same origin policy. The key is that the whole internet really does depend on domain-based trust and expects to be able to trust domain names, which is really a flawed thought. Little overview of the same origin policy. I mentioned that when it comes to domain-based trust flaws, this is probably what we're most interested in for our talk today. The goal of same origin policy is to prevent a resource loaded from one site from manipulating or communicating with another site. That sounds like a lot, but really it's as simple as, if you come to my site, evil.com, I should not be able to make you perform actions on bank.com, which is your banking site, under your context. Now, what we're concerned with is attacks that bypass the same origin policy and allow us to subvert that protection. It's really probably the most important protection that your browser provides you with your web application experience. So any attacks that bypass that are really useful. In this case, we have really two types of bypass attacks. There's a full bypass attack, which is basically connecting to any machine anywhere. And if any of you saw Billy Rios or I talk about anti-DNS pinning flaws at Hack in the Box Malaysia or saw those slides, that was a specific attack against a product that allowed us to do anti-DNS pinning to any machine anywhere. Rob's also talked about some of these attacks with Flash at such talks as TourCon and the other Black Hats we've been at in previous years. These attacks allowed us to make unrestricted access to any sites from where the content was hosted from in the context of that user. There's also partial attacks, where we're basically referencing content that we've uploaded onto a target site and using that to establish a bypass of same origin policy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about content ownership and what Billy likes to call content ownership. When an application takes ownership of user-supplied content, it really is quite a dangerous thing. We've talked about this at other conferences, such as at like DEF CON last year, where we showed Google's Gmail actually accepting cross-domain.xml policy files as attachments. And since those were hosted from that Gmail domain, we could then make subsequent bypass attacks using Flash, because a cross-domain policy file says that it's okay for you to be able to make cross-domain requests per Flash. So that's another example of this type of an issue. But for this one, we're going to use a new example. This is on code.google.com. And basically what we have here is we're uploading an arbitrary file to code.google.com by attaching the file to the issues portion of a project. And this is uploaded to and served from code.google.com. So this is pretty interesting. Now, we couldn't use our old example that we used at DEF CON last year of using a cross-domain policy file with Flash. And the reason is that Java and Flash handle the same origin policy differently. Java ties it down to domains. Flash ties it down to domains and the folder from which the cross-domain policy file was served from. So in this case, with code.google.com, we've created our own project. We have our own project directory. So if we had uploaded a cross-domain policy file, that wouldn't be useful to us unless we wanted to make cross-site request forgery attacks against our project code, which isn't really interesting. So instead, we use Java. Java doesn't have this restriction, so we can make cross-site request forgery attacks to all of google.com in that case. Here's an example of how we did this. Obviously, here we're creating a new project called cross-domain. We are now creating a new issue for that project. This is probably pretty similar to something like SourceForge or BugTrack, where you can comment on a piece of software and say, there's an issue with this software that I need you to handle. Similar to those sites, we also have the capability to attach files to further clarify the issue we're pointing out. You can see in this case, we've uploaded the file called xssniper3.jar. This is actually a Java archive that contains all of the class files for our applet. We are now serving an applet from Google's domain. This is a problem. Here's an example of some source code that we're going to now use to invoke that applet. This source code is going to be placed on a remote web server. It's probably extremely hard to read because of the small text, but the gist of the issue is the code base parameter for the applet, which is where the applet will get loaded from, is pointing to Google servers. And we're pointing to an archive, which is the jar file we just uploaded. That allows us to call the applet class from that remote archive. Now, what does this get us? This effectively allows us to create a bridge. And that bridge is going to be between our remote site, our evil.com site, to the actual application we're interested in attacking. The bridge is done like this. The applet that we've loaded to code.google.com is going to be loaded from the code.google.com domain. And therefore, by same origin policy, it can communicate with google.com as much as it wants. We're going to actually invoke that applet on the client side from our evil.com webpage. So our evil.com webpage can talk to the applet. So now through that, we've created a process, a bridge, from our side to the applet to code.google.com. And because applets will actually piggyback off the browser's cookies, this is something a lot of people don't realize. With applets, you can't actually access someone's cookies, but you can, in fact, piggyback off the browser's cookies as long as you're in line with the same origin policy. So because it'll piggyback off those cookies, we can drive authenticated actions on your behalf. So in this case, we have a good example of this, which I'm going to show right here. This is stealing the Google code password used to authenticate to google.com for the code piece. You can see that this applet is being loaded from Billy Rios' website, the xssniper.com website, and we're actually loading an applet from the code.google.com server, which allows us to make same origin bypass attacks against that server. Here we have the Google code password and the cross-site request forgery token to try to prevent cross-site request forgery attacks, and we could steal that from code.google.com. This is a pretty simple example. I think it, when it comes to same origin bypass, it probably gets no more simple than uploading an applet to a site and using that to bypass same origin policy. It's pretty obvious that when any site takes ownership of content like this that's executable and then serves it from its domain, that this is going to be an issue. I think this has been an issue for a long time. Maybe previously you might have thought of uploading like an ASP file that might get executed from the server. Well, this is the same type of thing. But what about if that wasn't a jar file? Would you have any concerns about a site that allows you to upload things like images, text, video, documents, or XML files? You should. You really should. Like I mentioned before in our DEF CON talk, and I'm not going to rehash on this issue again, if we can upload an XML file, we could possibly use that with Flash for cross-domain bypass, right? But the images, video, Word docs, these have a lot of issues potentially. They could have file format flaws that we could use against clients. But more importantly, for the purpose of our talk, we're going to actually talk about a new class of attacks that we call Jafar attacks. And we're going to talk about that right now. So enter Jafar attacks. We are not talking about the Aladdin character from Disney's movies. We are talking about Jafar attacks, which is a conjunction of the GIF extension and the JAR extension. Because that's really what this file is. It's not one type of file. It's a conjunction of both files, and it serves as both. Basically, what we're doing is we're combining a GIF file, which is a standard image file, with a JAR file, which is a Java archive for containing our applet code. This file is going to maintain the properties of both. So when we load it from a web page, it is effectively an image still. It will render as an image. But when we load it from the Sun Java virtual machine, it is also an applet, and it will run as an applet. So it's a very interesting vector. Now, why is this a big problem? Well, think of how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of sites are out there that allow us to upload things like images, video, documents, these types of things. Now you can understand the scope of we're not actually just uploading a simple image to all of these sites. We're uploading a jar or an applet that allows us to compromise these sites. So I'm going to ask you, what's wrong with this picture? That's actually correct. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this picture. This girl is beautiful. This picture, however, there is something wrong with this picture. It's not just that this guy's kind of ugly and shady looking here. It's also that this is not just an image. This is actually a JAR file as well. You can see that the image actually renders as an image, but it's also a JAR file. Now, just to prove that to you, we're opening this in a hex editor so that we can see the contents of the file. If you look at that red outlined piece on the far right-hand side, you'll see the GIF 89. That's the valid header description for a GIF file, saying that this is definitely a valid image. If we scan further down, you can see that there's actually content that would be included in an applet, in an archive. So you have the meta information for the manifest, and you actually have the name of the class within inside of the jar, jarpwn.class. This is Billy's title, by the way, just so you know. You have to throw the pwn in on everything possible. So what does this get us? Well, very similar to what it got us before when we uploaded a jar. It gets us a bridge. What's different about this bridge is created not by uploading specifically an applet, which is obviously bad and certainly not a good thing to allow. It's done by uploading an image or a video or a Word document. And start cataloging through your mind and think of all of the sites that allow you to do that. Social networking sites, online Word document editors, YouTube, anything else you can think of. There's so many sites out there that allow this kind of behavior. So a real-life example of this in action, we're going to use Google again. You're probably asking yourself, why are we picking on Google? We're not. Actually, Google seems to like us. We work with them quite a bit, and they're really good about fixing issues quickly, which is helpful when you find these types of issues just not that long before you submit your call for paper for Black Hat. So that helps. But also, their technology is something that people understand and certainly use quite a bit of, so it seems to have a bigger effect when you talk about it in those things. This is not to say that Google is the only one at fault for this. This is really not anyone's specific fault. It's a blended threat issue, so it's complex and hard to understand these interactions, but there's a ton of websites out there that are vulnerable to this type of issue. Here's an example. This is Picasa Web. This is Google's photo editing software, and it's actually an online web album where you can upload your photo albums. Here we're creating an album, and we're going to actually start uploading our images. You can see that right here. We're uploading our images. We're not just uploading any image. There's that shady guy again. We're uploading an image which is also a jar. You can see that this is actually getting rendered in the web page, and it renders quite nicely as an image. Although it's also an applet, which is now getting loaded from the picasaweb.google.com domain. So now we have effectively everything we need for a partial same origin bypass. Again, here's how we are going to load this code from a remote site, but it's a little tricky this time. This isn't a Java archive that we're loading this from specifically. It's not a .jar extension file. However, the JVM is nice enough to not really care about the extension of the file. So if you look where we specify the archive we're loading our classes from, it's actually the name of our GIF file with the .gif extension. So again, not just a valid image, also a valid jar file. You'll notice that the code base here is lh4.google.com. This is actually a fairly common consideration that web applications have taken into place. They'll actually try to load uploaded content from a subdomain that is not on any of their main domains. So if you're thinking you're Google, you want to protect things like mail.google.com, obviously, right? But when you're loading it from lh4.google.com, you're loading user-supplied content from there, you're thinking it's probably going to be protected. In most cases, it probably is, but we've actually, with this Jafar attack, figured out a few ways around this so that we can actually use everything from google.com as well, or any of google.com's subdomains. Now, we're not going to talk about this particular thing because it's actually not fixed at this time, so we'll leave that to your imagination for now. But we actually can, as we're proving here, communicate with mail.google.com now from that applet. This example is showing us from Billy's website actually stealing the contact list of a user from mail.google.com, all from this image, which is actually an archive, a Java archive, that we've uploaded to Picasa Web. Now, I mean, I think you're looking at this and you're saying, yeah, cool, you stole someone's contact list. Well, imagine all the other types of requests we can make to mail.google.com at this point. It's not just stealing someone's contact list. We can drive interactions for them on mail.google.com. So whose fault is this anyways? Well, I think it's pretty easy to blame Java for this, and I think a lot of people probably will, but that's not our stance on things. Our stance on things is that this is an application-level issue, and it's a very concerning application-level issue that affects numerous applications. The Java virtual machine is not the first thing that's ever been used for this type of attack. As I mentioned previously, we've used Flash for this before. There's been other types of attacks like this, and there certainly will be more in the future. This is an issue of content ownership. And if you're going to take content ownership of someone else's files, you need to protect the integrity of your domain name, and you need to serve that from a completely different domain name. So if Google had done, instead of lh4.google.com, if they had done images.google.com, that's a completely different domain name, and we would no longer be able to pull off this attack. But I think that really underlines that companies need to understand how browsers and other third-party extensions interpret the same origin policy and how things can be manipulated in this fashion to make these kinds of things happen. So again, I think, just rehash it real quick, basically we're tricking the Java virtual machine into believing that an image is also an applet, and we're loading applet content that allows us to create a bridge to the remote site we've loaded that content on. It's useful because a lot of sites out there actually allow us to upload files like images, documents, video, these types of things. And we're going to use this in conjunction with some of the other research that Rob and John have done to actually show how we could use this as a feasible attack for compromising an intranet or a company. I think that as you're going through this, it's going to feel like several different pieces of research, but we'll start to tie it all back together towards the end, and you'll start to see how all of these could be kind of used in conjunction for a very realistic attack. So I'll turn it over now to Rob Carter to talk about locally running web servers. I think this is important because more and more applications these days are starting to want to use HTTP inter-process communication. Good examples of this are Google Desktop and Picasa. They use this to extend features, to communicate between applications, all these types of things. But when you're running a locally running web server in an application, it's concerning because that's running on your local host. And in IE, that allows us to get into local intranet zone, which allows cross-zone attacks for cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery. I think a lot of people would be kind of shocked to realize that when you install something like Picasa, which is a photo album piece of software where you can edit pictures, you're actually also installing a web server, which is concerning. So I'll turn it over to Rob to talk about this.
All right. So like Nate said, this may seem to be completely unrelated to what he was talking about, but we're able to use these locally running web server attacks as standalone attacks, but we're also able to combine the research that I've done, John's done, and Nate's done to pull off things that are even more devastating. So first, a word about cross-zone scripting. Obviously, this is nothing new. This has been done for quite a long time. But I think the way that I've been doing it with the locally running web servers is somewhat novel. So I'm going to go ahead and explain that to you guys. So first of all, what are the zones in Internet Explorer? There's the Internet zone, which is a high security zone. There's the local intranet zone, which is medium to low security zone. Restricted zone, which is very high security. And the trusted zone, which is low security. Traditionally, with most cross-zone attacks that I've seen, we're trying to get into into the trusted zone, which provides you quite a bit of privileges through JavaScript and other scripting languages. But to get into the trusted zone, normally, without any kind of ninja hacker or super hacker type attacks, this requires user interaction and a trusted program to put you there. So we're going to concentrate on the local intranet zone. So great, now we're trying to get in the local intranet zone. How do we get in there? According to Microsoft's site, all network connections established with the Universal Naming Convention are in the local intranet zone. So if you're trying to access that Windows file share on your corporate network, that's done through the local intranet. Also, I believe this is correct. I'm not 100% on this. But if you access a web server that runs on the same system as the file share that you accessed earlier, I believe that's also done through the local intranet zone. Number two, websites that are in your proxy exemptions list are also in the local intranet zone. So also number three, websites with names that do not include periods, those requests will be performed in the local intranet zone. So one and two might be kind of difficult to do. But three is what we're going to concentrate on. Now, I'm going to mention some differences between Internet Explorer 6 and Internet Explorer 7. In Internet Explorer 6, the local intranet zone is enabled by default. And Microsoft made a design decision in Internet Explorer 7 where they disabled the local intranet zone by default. Now, if you're joined to a domain, it will actually detect that and enable the local intranet zone. There's also this weird other case that I discovered in VMware, where if you have a netted network in VMware, for some reason local intranet gets enabled. It doesn't work with a bridge network, but with a netted network it does. So I'm not exactly sure why that works. But so what's another name for 127.0.0.1? It's localhost. There's no periods in there. So that satisfies our conditions for number three. And also, all ports for localhost are fair game. So it doesn't matter if the web server is running on port 80. Doesn't matter if it's running on port 65,522. If we make a request to it, we're in the local intranet zone. All right, so now we're in the local intranet zone. What does this give us? I think for standalone attacks, the most damaging thing is the fact that the same origin policy is not strictly enforced in the local intranet zone like it is in the internet zone. In the internet zone, if you load code or load JavaScript from evil.com and that JavaScript tries to do an XML HTTP request to mail.google.com, that's not going to work at all. The browser's just going to stop it. It's going to throw an error. There's not even going to be a pop-up or anything. But in the local intranet zone, it'll pop up a dialog box saying something like, "This website is trying to access content it does not control. Would you like to allow this?" Now, okay, it requires some user interaction, but I'm going to rely on some statistics that I saw in Dan Kaminsky's talk yesterday, where he found this consumer reports survey that basically said, you know, what users do and what they say they do are two totally separate things. 90%+ of users will just click right through that, and we'll have access to whatever domain we want, mail.google.com, myspace.com, linkedin.com, whatever. So also, this getting into the local intranet zone is useful for other attacks requiring the lowered privileges of that zone, like John's password hash stealer, which he's going to explain later. And then some lower risk issues, like the phishing filter is disabled, Pop-up blockers disabled. There are no size or positioning constraints for new windows created from the local internet zone. Those can be useful for social engineering attacks, or, you know, whatever else. I mean, we haven't used these particular features in any of the research that we've done, but who knows, it could be used in future topics. So the first vulnerability for a locally running web server that I'm going to explain here is in the Azurius web UI. It's cross-site scripting. I'm sure many of you have heard of Azurius. It's a popular torrent client. And it comes with a web UI plugin built in, but it's not enabled by default. A lot of people do enable it because, you know, maybe you have your box on your, you have Azurius installed on your work computer. You like how fast the work internet connection is, and you're working on the weekend, but you want to still keep your torrent downloads going. So, you know, you have your remote administration interface for doing that kind of stuff. So we've got cross-site scripting. So basically, these are just alerts. This is just a proof of concept, but obviously you can include remote scripts into this and do the same origin bypass or other malicious activities. The next one is an XSS in the Eclipse help system. And this was kind of the impetus for all this research. I was flying back from Washington, D.C. to Houston, and we had just met with the MSRC, and they were trying to get us in touch with the Adobe product security team. And we were working on our Flash DNS rebinding exploit at the time, and I was putting some proof of concept code together for the Adobe team. I was using Flex Builder, which is based on Eclipse. And so I needed some help documentation for some function that I didn't know the parameters for. And so I opened it up, this window popped up, and for a split second in the title bar said 127.0.0.1 colon some port number. It's like, wow, what is that? It almost looks like there's a web server. So I did a little bit of digging in my system, and turns out that Flex Builder, which is based on Eclipse, actually starts an Apache Coyote web server on your local system and serves up this JSP web application. Now, there are a lot of popular products that are based on Eclipse. Obviously, like I said, Flex Builder, IBM WebSphere, SAP NetWeaver, JBoss Eclipse, Borland JBuilder, MyEclipse, Zen Studio. List goes on and on. So it's a nice big attack area for us. And here's an example of the cross-site scripting vector. As you can see in the second one, we're including a remote script from 1.2.3.4 called a.js. And this last one, I think, is the most interesting and probably the most devastating. There's actually also cross-site scripting, but the thing that's most worrying is probably the CSRF that is in the uTorrent web UI. So uTorrent, another popular torrent client, it also has a web UI plugin. Starts a web server on the local host, and like Azurius, useful for remote administration. And unfortunately, there were problems with the implementation, namely cross-site scripting and CSRF. And this cross-site scripting that's in the screenshot is actually persistent. Actually, there's supposed to be three CSRFs in this slide. There's only two, but the first CSRF that we do, we do it to turn on the move completed downloads to option. And before I go any further, I want to just clarify that this attack is purely CSRF. There's no JavaScript or anything, and we can use it to own your box, basically. So turns on the move completed downloads to option. Second CSRF we perform, we set the folder that we move the completed download to, and we set that to C:\Documents and Settings, all users, start menu, program, startup. And that's the XP example for Vista. We can do the same thing for a different path. And then the last CSRF we have to perform is to tell uTorrent to download this torrent file. And then uTorrent conveniently will automatically start the download for us. And then once it's completed that download, it will move that file over to the start menu. And let's say we have a download in executable or batch file. The user reboots, and we have arbitrary command execution on their system. So along with arbitrary command execution, that's not the only thing we can do. The underlying problem for this issue is the fact that we can download any file we want and put it on anywhere on the file system. So think maybe a jar. We could have it download a jar and put it anywhere on the file system. So remember that for later. All right, and this is what the uTorrent settings are going to look like if they look at their downloads preferences after this attack has happened. All right, so now I'm going to turn it over to John. He's going to talk about his Java attacks. As Dan Kaminsky noted yesterday, John is the resident Java bastard. So he's had quite a run of vulnerabilities in Java recently. And the nice thing about Java is the market penetration. Roughly 90% of desktops run the JVM. So he's going to explain his research and how it ties into the rest of our stuff. So,
thanks, Rob. So my name is John Heisman, and I work for NGS Software based in Seattle. And as Rob said, over the last 18 months, I've been doing a lot of research into Java on the client side. And when I start explaining some of the flaws I found, typical response from people is, you run Java? You know, no one runs Java these days. Who needs it when you have Flash and you have Ajax? And really, the question isn't who runs Java. It should be who has Java installed. And the answer is pretty much everyone. So as the statistic says there, 90% of desktops run Java SE. And that's slightly lower than Flash, which is about 95. And most OEMs will actually ship the Java runtime environment. And most corporate systems, most corporate machines, it's also installed. Say, a financial institution has a Java enterprise app, they probably need the Java runtime on their client machines so that some applets they've written can connect to it. So this section on Java is going to be split into a few different parts. Ultimately, I'm going to show how we can write an applet that will steal your Windows password hashes, or effectively let us carry out an NTLM relay attack and make authenticated requests in your organization using your credentials. But there's a few steps that lead up to that. So really I have a few kind of tricks that an unsigned applet can perform. So these are, I guess you could call them features. These are by design in the APIs. So this first one here, not sure if it's particularly clear. Effectively, there's a function get network interfaces, and an unsigned applet can call this, and it can enumerate all the network interfaces on your machine. So this is quite a handy function when our applet starts up, kind of just to see how the land lies. We can enumerate network interfaces looking for, say, VMware, looking for common VPN adapter names. Also, we can kind of see how the land lies with respect to your wireless and Bluetooth interfaces. By default, an applet cannot make DNS requests. So an unsigned applet is subject to the Java same origin policy, which says it can only connect to the host that it was served from. So we obviously can't connect to a DNS server because that would break the same origin policy. Well, a while back I discovered a little trick that ultimately leaked the DNS name. You can use the JNDI, which is Java's abstraction of all kind of naming schemes like LDAP and DNS. It's a Java native directory interface, I think. And making a JNDI request ultimately leaks an exception, a security exception that tells us what the internal DNS server is. So you can imagine that's quite useful. As I said on the previous slide, ultimately an unsigned applet cannot make arbitrary DNS requests. You get the access control exception. Well, there's a way around this. The Java runtime environment installs an ActiveX control called isInstalled that you're supposed to use to determine, one, whether the Java runtime is even installed, and two, specifically what version is installed. And this has a method, DNS resolve, so we can just pass it a host name and it will actually do a DNS lookup for us. Incidentally, this DNS resolve method had a buffer overflow in it that was reported to Sun, not by myself, but reported about a year ago, which brought it to my attention. But this is kind of useful because now we can effectively hit your intranet DNS server and ask it whether particular hosts exist. So just as on a pen test, an infrastructure pen test, you might try and brute force host names doing DNS lookups. We can do something similar, but from an unsigned applet. So, for instance, we might try and locate file shares or, you know, a machine called accounting or the SQL servers in your organization. So, assume we've written an applet that has enumerated all your network interfaces and it's also done some DNS lookups and found some potentially interesting hosts. Well, how do we know? I guess the next step is which of those hosts are up? Well, according to the same origin policy, we can only connect back to the site that served us. But interestingly, there is one function, is reachable, which is in the java.net.inet address class. And this function is implemented in native code. And so ultimately, it flies under the radar of Java's security manager. And what it lets us do is it will do a TCP connect on port 7, the echo port, to see if the host is up, basically. And if it gets a any kind of response, positive or negative, that that port is open or closed, then ultimately it knows that host is up. So we can use this from an unsigned applet to quickly scan subnets and see what's available. Oh, and interestingly here, you'll note that in the API, what the first parameter is a network interface object. So we can actually, having enumerated all your network interfaces, we can basically use each network interface in this function call to see, you know, is for example, this host available through the VPN? Is it available through your wireless card, that kind of thing? So I'm now going to talk about loading content from localhost. And I hope at this point you'll start to see how Nate's research and Rob's research kind of ties into this. As Rob alluded to, there are ways of getting content cached on a local machine. And when Java loads content from the local machine, it kind of treats it differently. So you'll see here I mentioned the file protocol handler. The key point here is that Java implements its own protocol handlers, just like the browser does. So when I talk about file colon slash slash C colon, ultimately that's passed by Java. That's nothing to do with the browser. So by default, when you load an applet from the local file system, it's allowed to read files from the same directory. So if we're able to cache an applet on the root of your C drive, then that unsigned applet would have full access to read access to your drive. If we load an applet from file system, or we load it from localhost, so for example, if you had a web server on your machine that was serving some content, and we were able to load a jar from it, then there's a couple of the kind of network restrictions are actually relaxed a bit. So firstly, we're able to enumerate all the IP addresses bound to each adapter. So really, that takes the kind of enumeration of the network adapters just one step further. And this is a kind of interesting one. We're allowed to listen on a port, so we're allowed to bind a port, and we're able to accept connections from localhost. Really, this is actually congruent with the same origin policy. Java lets any applet bind a socket, bind a port, but it only allows the host from which the content was served to actually connect to it. So if you load a jar from google.com, as was illustrated earlier, then only google.com can connect to your machine. So that way, if we load from a local file system or from a web server on localhost, then effectively we can bind a port and allow localhost to make requests. And finally, it's also quite an interesting point that if we can have an applet loaded from JRE slash lib slash ext, so basically the default installation folder for Java, C program files, Java slash JRE 1.6 or whatever slash lib slash ext, then Java by default automatically grants your code the java.security.all permission, which basically means your code is fully trusted. So if we can basically make an applet think it was loaded from that directory, then there is no sandbox. That applet can do anything. It can run code on your machine, it can load native code, it can make arbitrary network connections and read write any file. So an example of a same origin bypass that ultimately lets us run code on your machine. This was patched by Sun in March. And you can see we have a standard applet tag. We have the code and the code base. So the code specifies the actual name of the class, some class, and the code base specifies where's the applet actually loaded from, some URL. And below that, we have the definition of the URL constructor in Java. And basically, as you might imagine, what it does is combine the code base and the code to basically form an absolute URL, which tells it where to actually go and grab the class file from. But this interesting kind of snippet that I found in the Java documentation for this for the URL constructor, which basically says if you have a URL constructed of two parts, so an absolute part and a relative part, if the relative part itself is absolute, so if I have an absolute part of, say, HTTP foo and a relative part of HTTP bar, when you combine those two with the URL constructor, you end up with HTTP bar. So the relative part is actually promoted. The relative part wins. However, the interesting kind of effect here is that as far as the Java Security Manager is concerned, the applet has been loaded from HTTP foo. So it thinks it's loaded from the absolute part, whereas in reality you've loaded it from the relative part. So when I first found this, I thought, you know, that's the same origin bypass, which will be useful in some other attacks. But then I realized that all we had to do was specify the relative part of, sorry, the absolute part of file colon C program files Java JRE lib ext. Because if you remember from the last slide, I said that code loaded from that folder is granted all permissions. So effectively, not only did this issue end up being a same origin bypass, but it also led directly to compromising the browser. So I'm now going to tie in NTLM, so some Windows technology here. A quick primer on NTLM. When your browser makes a request to a authenticated a site that requires NTLM authentication, basically you make the request. The server then replies with an HTTP 401 saying you have to authenticate. Your client then requests the same resource, and this time it sends a base64 encoded NTLM message, a type 1 message. And the type 1 message contains your domain name, your username, and your host name. The client will then respond with another, sorry, the server will respond with another 401, and it will send you a base64 encoded type 2 message. This time it will send you a challenge. You then reply finally with a base64 encoded type 3 message, where basically you've taken your credentials and encrypted them with the challenge. And then finally the server takes that type 3 message, goes off and does its magic to check that you've supplied the right credentials, and then authenticates you, returns 200. How's that useful and how does that apply to Java? Supposing we have an applet that we've been able to cache on the file system. So Rob mentioned one way of getting an applet cached. There are several that just involve Java itself, the Java browser plugin. I'm not going to go into those because Sun is still investigating those. But suffice to say, there are ways of getting content on the local system. We reference that content from the local system. And as far as the Java security model goes, this allows us to bind a port on localhost. You'll see in that code snippet here, I call server socket binding port 1234, and I bind it to 127.0.0.1. The reason I bind it to 127.0.0.1 instead of just calling the standard server socket constructor is because on Windows, if we bind to localhost, the firewall doesn't complain. So ultimately what I'm attempting to do here is cache an applet on the file system, load it from the file system, and turn it into a web server. The second reason I use localhost, or rather the IPv4 address for localhost, is that in the Java code, it explicitly references 127.0.0.1 when you load it from the local file system. So if on, say, a dual stack OS like Vista, I just call the server socket API, then it will end up binding the IPv6 address rather than the IPv4 address. So in this impossible to read blue text, effectively I set up the web server and I tell IE via an iframe to connect to my web server. So we end up with this. We have three applets running in our browser. Applet one is loaded from the internet, and applet one's sole purpose is to set up applet two. And it sets it up by caching it on the local file system. Applet two, when it's loaded, is loaded from the local file system, and therefore is able to set up this web server. So your machine effectively has a web server on localhost. Applet 2 then tells the browser, you need to connect to me. And when the browser connects to our web server says, you need to authenticate. So at this point, because we're connecting to HTTP localhost and we're in the local intranet zone, Internet Explorer will automatically authenticate. So our Java applet web server is now able to effectively control the NTLM authentication process. Now, I'm sure many of you are familiar with NTLM relaying attacks, in that, you know, they've been around for a good 10 years, I'd say. But traditionally, NTLM relay attacks, they've been considered an intranet-only attack. Well, this goes to show we can actually carry it out from the internet with Java. So where does applet 3 fit into the picture? With applet 3, we use a same origin bypass, such as the one I showed you that was patched. And applet 3, we connect to a site on your intranet that requires authentication. So Outlook Web Access, for example. And at this point, applet 2 speaks to applet 3, and applet 3 speaks to the intranet website. And when the intranet website says, you need to authenticate, then applet 3 says to applet 2, pass me those hashes that you got earlier, and effectively we authenticate. So the end result is applet 3 can also speak to applet 1 and ship these requests off the box. So basically, using a combination of these three Java applets and the default behavior for Internet Explorer in an organization, we can effectively create an authenticated proxy and proxy intranet sites outside the organization. Okay, I'm briefly going to talk about something slightly different, another Java attack I've been working on. Effectively, as Nate said, there's a growing number of online document editing websites, and basically some of these are implemented as Java applets, and the one I looked at a while ago was called ThinkFree. And basically when you run a signed Java applet, you get a box like this. Pretty similar to when you install an ActiveX control on in your browser. But the key thing here is that users agree to trust a publisher rather than a publisher and a particular URL. So, and by default, as I've highlighted here, effectively that tick box is checked so that if you've trusted them once, then you'll never be prompted again whether you want to trust them. So basically, repurpose attacks, which have been pretty widely known against ActiveX, where the developer just doesn't really think about the use case correctly, those are alive and well for signed Java applets, as I will demonstrate. So ThinkFree is a signed Java applet, and it needs to be signed because it's this kind of thing that looks a lot like Word 2003, and it lets you save files to your local disk, so it needs to be signed to be able to do that. And the problem with ThinkFree was that it's a big application, so they split it across multiple jars to try and speed up how it actually loads. And what they did, the very first jar is signed, which causes the dialog I showed you, and then all the remaining jar files are actually unsigned, and they implement their own class loader, which says, well, we'll just load these other jars and treat them as if they were signed. So it's a pretty simple attack. On a malicious website, we host the original loader jar, the one that's signed. We assume our victim has already actually run ThinkFree and has kept the default settings of trusting the ThinkFree publisher. Therefore, they won't be asked again, even though we're loading the content from a different website. As I said, you're trusting the publisher. You're not trusting the combination of publisher and URL. The original loader jar loads, and it starts to reference the second jar. The second jar is unsigned, so we can tamper with it, put our own code in there, and as I said, it will be loaded and trusted. So basically, this resulted in a potential compromise of all ThinkFree users in a one-by-one pixel, so totally silent compromise. So ThinkFree patched this May this year. But my point here is that signed jar for applets are kind of common in a lot of organizations, and a lot of people don't think of them like ActiveX objects. But pretty much all of the same attacks apply. At this point, I'm going to hand back to Nate, who's going to wrap it up with some more document editing.
All right, so you can see we're playing musical chairs here with all these researchers in action, but it's been a pretty fun process, actually. this attack is another type of Web 2.0 online document editing attack. This one's, again, against Google. And the title is called I Am the Mayor of Oak Tree, and you'll see a bit about that in just a second here, which kind of is a funny inside thing since how we figured this attack out. If anybody remembers when Google came out with Google Docs, it was a really interesting time, and I think it's a pretty cool piece of software. They had a nice video that they put together on it that showed how to use it, and actually Billy and I were watching that video, I think the day it came out, and noticed that they were actually referencing a document called Oak Tree. And it was a fictional document that was created to illustrate the purposes of online document editing and these types of things. And we noted that when they made requests for this in the browser, you could see the URL address bar there. It's similar to what we saw in the video. There is a docid parameter that contains a semi-random but mostly predictable document ID. And that document ID actually is what controls which document you're accessing. Now, the problem with this comes in when you realize that there is no authentication or authorization controls around the access of that document. So this product that you're supposed to, you know, edit your online documents with, put your documents up online, share them with collaborators, it now is possible to view your documents no matter who you give access to. So in this case, we use an unauthenticated user. We've not even authenticated to Google at all. And we've browsed to this document, and we've actually can view this document. This was interesting, but we couldn't edit the document, which we found kind of boring without that piece. So we looked into it a bit further and realized that once we actually authenticated, there was no authorization check. So all it checked to see was that you were authenticated, and we can now edit the document. Now, when we tested this out, this is the kind of issue you simply can't test out just by browsing to this piece of functionality. You have to actually see if you can do this. So the story was edited to maybe not talk about Oak Tree so much, but to mention that we were, in fact, the mayor of Oak Tree, and that was where that title came from. When we actually submitted this to modify the document, it obviously did submit, and so we quickly got in contact with Google to get the issue fixed, and as usual, Google very quickly turned that around and got that issue fixed. But that said, there was other paths to becoming mayor. And we found these, you know, throughout the next couple days and weeks. And we actually realized that there were several features within the online document editor that allowed you to share your document. That's actually probably one of the coolest pieces about Google software is the just interactivity of the applications, the ease of use for those types of things. But it also becomes a pinch point for attacks. So in this case, we were able to use the email collaborators feature, which would allow me as a document writer to email anybody else that I want to work on this document, sending them the document and sending them the capabilities to view that document and edit that document. So when you click this functionality, you'd simply note that when the request is made, it sends the doc ID for the document you're giving control to. Well, I don't care about giving control to my document. I care about giving control to your document back to me. So I email myself as a collaborator and change my document ID parameter to anybody else's document ID parameter. And I could do this for a lot of document IDs. And now I'm going to get emailed everybody's document and access to edit and view those documents. So very interesting attack path there. Similarly, we could actually publish the document to a blog. So if you had a Blogger account set up, you could actually publish the document to your Blogspot blog. Now, obviously, again, you don't care about publishing your own document. You care about publishing somebody else's. So you modify the doc ID parameter that controls which one's going to get published. The third and final way to do this was to upload a crossdomain.xml file, which, you know, instead of a document, this is, again, back to another example of same origin bypass. This goes back more similarly to what Billy and I talked about at DEF CON, which is going to use Flash to bypass same origin policy. So there was numerous ways around this. Of course, at this point, Google's now fixed all of these, so that's a good thing. But it just shows that I think when you try to emulate desktop applications, such as Word editors and things of this nature, there's some additional things that have to be considered. And obviously, these types of attacks are, again, something that no web application firewall is going to protect you from. So if you have applications that your company develops similar to these, that have authentication or authorization issues, this is not something you can simply scan for. This is something that really requires you to dig into the design of the application and take a look at how it actually works. I'm going to bring up Rob for a final point. This is other oddities, and this is some JSON injection attacks that we use for origin spoofing for Google Gears. Now, this is actually going to be pretty useful because it does feed back into our original concept, which is to put applets on the local file system that we can then use to compromise a company. So I'm going to turn it over to Rob for this.
All right, I promise this is going to be the last time we pick on Google, probably because this is the last example of any vulnerabilities we found. All right, so what is Google Gears? Gears was made in the same vein as products such as Adobe Air or Java Web Start. So it basically makes it so that you can have web applications that can be used when you're offline. So the way Gears works, for Internet Explorer, DLLs are installed on your local system. And for Firefox, Zool objects are installed. So when you visit a page that wants to run Gears code, Gears will prompt you and ask you if you'd like to trust this code. And it looks a little something like this. So the first thing you can see here, it says Google Code. That's the name we've provided for our application. In the red box there, this is actually the domain or IP address that the application originates from. This is not supposed to be something that the user can tamper with. They're not supposed to be able to modify this. And then below that is our description of the application, our trusted Google Code Gears application for pwning you. And then to the left of that is the Google G. And then underneath all of that is a checkbox that says, I trust this site, allow to use Google Gears. And you have to check that in order to enable the allow button that's below that. So that's a pretty good pop-up box to make sure that users aren't doing anything they're not supposed to be doing. So first of all, when a Gears application is created, an ActiveX object is instantiated in Internet Explorer. I'm going to stick with Internet Explorer just for clarity. Then I did a little bit of research. At the time I was doing this, the get permission function wasn't really documented all that well. And the nice thing about Gears is that it's an open source project, and so you can just go out to code.google.com and look through the source code to your heart's content. So that's what I did, and I figured out what kind of parameters the get permission function accepts. And this is an example of it right here. Hopefully you can read that. When I call I create the factory object, then I call the get permission method of that factory object, and then I provide it a application name, the icon for the application, which is the Google G, and then the description for the application. Okay, so basically how this works, when you call the get permission function, Gears is passing the information from those parameters from the modal dialog box, from the JavaScript through a JSON object to the modal dialog box, and the modal dialog box is basically just HTML with JavaScript inside of it. And there's a JavaScript function inside of this that will parse the JSON object. And so it turns out there's an issue with that function. And as you can see in this JSON object, right next to the word code, there's a backslash. And when I was messing around with this, as you know, playing with Unicode encoded characters, and so basically this JavaScript that was interpreting this would convert these back into ASCII, and so when I had this backslash in front of the double quote, it threw a JavaScript exception. So I was like, what's going on here? So I figured out that the custom name parameter doesn't sanitize for double quotes at all. So you can take the double, or you can take this parameter, insert a double quote, and then insert your own origin, because conveniently enough, the origin parameter in the JSON object comes at the very end. So we, in this example, we've inserted code.google.com as our trusted domain. And our resulting dialog box looks something like this. So most users are probably going to trust that, maybe not everyone in this room. But so then they're going to trust this. And so the thing with Gears is that you can force it to, well, actually this is real functionality of Gears. You can have it cache resources from the web server on the local file system. So you can have it cache HTML pages, JavaScript files, images, executables, jar files, and those are all cached to a semi-predictable location that's not very difficult to guess. So you can imagine where I'm going with this. All right, so that brings us to our conclusions and thoughts, and I'm going to hand this back over to Nate.
So I think basically with the Google Gears thing, it's just another example of how we could actually cache a JAFAR or a jar file down in the local file system and then use this in conjunction with some of John's attacks, which really take advantage of those additional permissions for applets. We actually know about several ways of doing this right now, none of which are currently fixed except for, I guess, the Google Gears one, because we can no longer spoof the origin, which is a good thing. So hopefully if you see a message saying you're going to load Google Gears from an untrusted site, you just won't load that. But these are certainly very valid attack vectors. I think that kind of points to the thought that blended threats really lead to some unexpected attack paths. If you take all of the things that we just talked about individually, probably only some of the stuff that John talked about is really concerning. And when you think about it from that standpoint, you think, well, how are you going to put an applet onto my file system? You just can't do that, right? But when you take all these things in conjunction put together, it creates a really nice attack vector for taking a large-scale attack against a company. In fact, in this case, the attacks, especially some of the JAFAR attacks that we talked about, this could be used fairly easily on a large number of websites and feed into somewhat of a worm-like attack that we could use across websites hitting tons of users. So it's a very concerning attack vector. Again, for anyone that didn't catch this, this has nothing to do with cross-site scripting, like some of the media coverage on our topic might have led you to believe. That may be a deployment vector for this, but it's really not required at all. So this isn't something that, you know, simple application scanning tools or web application firewalls or anything of that nature are going to protect you from. And that's what's really most concerning about this stuff. This is really design-level issues that we're exploiting on a kind of grand scale here. Kind of a final thought that I've had with all of this stuff is when you think about some of the attacks that we talked about in a virtualized environment or in some of the cloud computing environments that are becoming really popular topics, it really gets scary. I think if you think about like a good example, and just because it's something that's quick to mind because we're talking about Google so much here, AppSpot. You can all host your own applications from AppSpot, and it's named all under the AppSpot.com domain. So if me, Rob, and John each have our own applications, it might be nate.appspot.com, rob.appspot.com, and john.appspot.com. And the thing with that is that they're all loaded from the AppSpot.com domain. So if any one of us is vulnerable to this JAFAR image uploading attack or things like this, then all of us are actually vulnerable. The user base of all of our applications are vulnerable. And that's what's pretty concerning. And I think it kind of leads to thinking, if we really suck right now at protecting our physical systems, our very real systems that we understand and can see, how are we going to be very good at protecting our virtual systems in these cloud computing environments? It's maybe something to take away when you think about implementing those yourself. When you hear the term cloud computing, realize that right now it is very much a buzzword, and you might not really be getting a lot of benefit, but you might be getting a significant amount of increase in security risk. So it's very concerning. With that, I'm going to turn it over for any questions you guys might have, and we'll go from there.
Do
you want this for questions? If anyone has any questions, go ahead and come up to the mic, and we're going to have a mic up there for you.
Hello.
Got questions?
Can I ask you a question, mate?
Yeah. Go ahead.
When you were saying with the Jafar, you could get rid of the subdomain for like hl4.google.com. Can you also drop back to .com?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually. John, did we think about that at all? You know, come talk to me after. That's obviously really concerning.
Sure. I've got another question. What would be the impact for sites to simply start wrapping any content that came from an external location with some type of tag simply saying, this isn't ours, and allowing the browsers to adjudicate accordingly?
Could you say it again?
Wrapping content, whether it be a picture, any content that's not generated from that site, wrapping in some type of browser tag so that the client browser can then adjudicate and say, well, gee, I'm going to take extra steps. I'm not going to trust it in this domain. I'm going to do whatever based on knowing that it's not associated with this site, even if it's hosted there.
Well, I think that's really part of the fix, right? I think the whole fix is that when you're accepting content from a user, you want to load it from a domain that is not the domain you're trying to protect. So instead of Google.com, image is Google.com. When you're talking about loading remote resources, like I think what you're saying, the risk would not be on you in particular. It would be on the remote site that has that uploaded content. Is that
kind of, but like if I had, you know, if I'm letting users upload images, when I then go back and host that image, could I put untrusted, you know, just a tag untrusted around the image or in the image tag so that the browser knows implicitly that this came from somewhere else?
No, because really we're not loading the applet through the image tags. We're actually loading the applet through applet tags. So as long as that applet resides in a web accessible location, we can load the applet.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, no problem.
So I have a couple of questions about the Jafar attack. You said this hybrid format works because the GIF metadata is near the start of the format and the JAR metadata is at the end. So which other data formats might you be able to do that with? And which other executable formats could you put at the end? So
yeah,
Silverlight looks like a zip, right? And the second question was, is there an easy defense that you can use to prevent the attack?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. There is numerous types of content that we can use this with. Basically anything that will process from the head down and ignore pieces. Like almost all the processors out there just look for the specific header that says I'm a GIF or I'm a Word doc or whatever it might be, and they start processing from there. So effectively what we have is we have two legitimate header files for each different type of file. And since GIF just says, oh, this is a GIF and I'm going to read, and then, oh, this is the end of the GIF, the rest is a bunch of cruft I don't care about, and still processes it fine. And the JAR says, I'm looking for my JAR header, I'm looking for my JAR header, and there it is. And then starts processing, and this is a valid JAR. That's all the examples where this is going to happen. And we've done this with actually all the images, all the image files you can think of, most of the video files you can think of, MP3s, SWIFT files, PDFs, docs, just about anything. Then I think the question was also, is there good ways to sanitize this? There is not really a good way that we've seen to sanitize this, because really you have two specifically valid files. I think some places have tried to do this, but it's pretty difficult. And actually, PDP has talked to me recently about the new Office document formats, and it may be that you can actually make a JAR file that is actually an Office document file as well, but not in the sense of both files at the same time, in the sense of it's just one file. And that's because of the way that that whole specification's done. But I think that it's really difficult to process this and figure those things out. What we have seen as valid fixes is obviously hosting it on a different domain, or we've seen sites that in some cases will take and compress an image or convert an image regardless of how it comes in. There will be some sites where, like, you send an image in a specific way and it won't compress it or convert it because it's exactly what it's looking for. There's other sites where it will compress or convert just by default, and that actually strips out our jar stuff at the end of the file. So that's another maybe effective way of protecting. But yeah, thanks.
Related to that question, was it as trivial as just concatenating a jar onto the end of a GIF to compose a Jafar file?
Yeah, literally it was. It's basically like a command line copy command that we use to copy the two files together. It's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
You can actually, I think, I don't know that we published that anywhere, but on the New Citizen blog, PDP talked about the combination of these two types of files back in Black Hat Europe. Mm-hmm. Didn't have the same intended exploit path as we used, but he talked about how these two things could be combined, and I think he actually has the exact command that you would use for this. So.
Thank you.